From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
After completing this exhaustive process, I have decided to nominate an inspiring woman who I believe will make a great justice, Judge Sonia Sotomayor of the great state of New York.
Thank you, Mr. President, for the most humbling honor of my life. You have nominated me to serve on the country's highest court, and I am deeply moved.
President Obama nominates federal judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. If confirmed, she'll become the nation's first Latina justice. We'll host a roundtable discussion on her nomination. Then thousands take to the streets after the California Supreme Court upholds Proposition 8 that bans gay marriage. We'll get reaction. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama's nominated Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. If confirmed, she would become the nation's first Hispanic justice. Speaking at the White House Tuesday, Obama hailed her experience and background.
After completing this exhaustive process, I have decided to nominate an inspiring woman who I believe will make a great justice, Judge Sonia Sotomayor of the great state of New York. Over a distinguished career that spans three decades, Judge Sotomayor has worked at almost every level of our judicial system, providing her with a depth of experience and a breadth of perspective that will be invaluable as a Supreme Court justice.
Judge Sotomayor is 54 years old. She's the daughter of Puerto Rican parents who raised her in a public housing project in the Bronx. If confirmed, she would become the nation's 111th justice and the third woman to hold a seat on the court. Sotomayor is Obama's first appointment of a new justice since taking office. The vacancy opened up with Justice David Souter's pending retirement at the end of the Supreme Court's term next month. At least two Republican lawmakers have already cited Sotomayor's race and gender in questioning her nomination. Congressmember Lamar Smith of Texas said he's concerned Sotomayor has already displayed, quote, personal bias based on ethnicity and gender. Meanwhile, Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma said, quote, it will be important for those of us in the U.S. Senate to weigh her qualifications and character as well as her ability to rule fairly without undue influence from her own personal race, gender, or political preferences. We'll have more on Sotomayor's nomination after headlines. California's Supreme Court has upheld a ballot measure banning gay marriage. Last November, a slight majority of California voters approved Proposition 8, which defines marriage as solely between a man and a woman. On Tuesday, the court rejected lawsuits arguing Proposition 8 was not simply a constitutional amendment, but a constitutional revision requiring legislative approval. In San Francisco, around 175 people were arrested after blockading traffic to protest the decision.
I am more determined than ever now that the court has said that Stuart and I have a fully legal marriage in the state of California after 22 years together, that I am more determined than ever to make that a reality for every loving, committed couple in our state.
The court did rule to preserve the 18,000 same-sex marriages that took place while gay marriage was legal in California. We'll have more on the Prop 8 ruling later in the broadcast. The top U.S. Army officer says the U.S. is prepared to remain in Iraq for a decade, despite an agreement to withdraw forces by 2012. Speaking in Washington, Army Chief of Staff General George Casey suggested the U.S. could remain in Iraq longer than pledged because of global events. Casey said, quote, global trends are pushing in the wrong direction. They fundamentally will change how the Army works, he said. In Afghanistan, a human rights group is claiming an Afghan prisoner at Guantanamo was only 12 years old when he was jailed, not 17 or 18, as the Pentagon claims. Mohammed Jawad has been jailed at Guantanamo for more than 6 years. Many poor Afghans don't know their exact ages because of a lack of accurate records. The Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission says interviews with his family show Jawad likely wasn't even a teenager when he was captured. The group also says Jawad suffered repeated torture in both Afghan and U.S. custody. A small town in Montana is offering to hold Guantanamo Bay prisoners should President Obama go away ahead with his vow to close the military jail. City officials in Hardin have offered up a recently built prison that's yet to house a single prisoner. Hardin is Montana's poorest county and had built the prison in the hopes of reviving its economy. In Pakistan, about 30 people were killed and another 250 wounded in an attack earlier today. Armed gunmen opened fire on police and intelligence offices in the city of Lahore and then set off a car bomb when government forces returned fire. It was one of the deadliest attacks in Pakistan this year and the third to hit Lahore in several months. Government officials say it could be retaliation for the U.S.-backed offensive that's displaced hundreds of thousands in Pakistan's Swat Valley. At least 168 people have been killed in a deadly cyclone in eastern India and Bangladesh. The toll is expected to rise as rescue workers reach areas cut off by deadly mudslides. Thousands of people have been displaced following heavy storms that destroyed their homes. A top UN official is calling for a war crimes probe in Sri Lanka's internal conflict between governmental forces and Tamil Tiger rebels. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, says both sides, quote, grossly disregarded the fundamental principle of the inviolability of civilians. Last week, the Sri Lankan government declared victory after a 26-year war and a recent spike in fighting that displaced some 300,000 people. The Bolivian and Venezuelan governments are dismissing Israeli accusations they've supplied uranium for Iran's nuclear program. On Monday, a leaked Israeli intelligence document said both Bolivia and Venezuela have aided Iran's nuclear development. Bolivian presidential minister Juan Roman Quintana ridiculed the charge.
Really, it forms part of the anthology of stupidity. If there's something that characterizes our policy as a government, it is a policy of peace.
Es la política de la paz.
Bolivia says it hasn't produced uranium in more than 25 years. Back in the United States, a landmark trial against oil giant Royal Dutch Shell's alleged involvement in human rights violations in the Niger Delta has been delayed until next week. Shell's accused of several abuses, including complicity in the execution of Nigerian writer and environmentalist Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight other activists. On Capitol Hill, a group of Democrats are threatening to derail a landmark climate and emissions bill to address concerns by the nation's ethanol producers. The bill would cut greenhouse gas emissions 17% below 2005 levels by 2020 and 83% by 2050. House Agricultural Committee Chair Colin Peterson says he's gathered 40 Democrats to oppose the measure unless it counters a recent EPA finding that indirect land use must be taken into account when calculating ethanol's carbon footprint. A newly released FBI recording shows Senator Roland Burris promised to donate money to then-Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich at the same time as he was seeking a Senate appointment. Blagojevich appointed Burris to President Obama's vacated Senate seat just weeks after Blagojevich was arrested on corruption charges. Burris has previously claimed he never discussed the Senate seat with Blagojevich or anyone acting on his behalf. And the activist medical anthropologist Paul Farmer is reportedly in talks for an appointment by the Obama administration to run U.S. health projects overseas. The Boston Globe reports Farmer told colleagues of the potential appointment earlier this month. Farmer's founder of the charity Partners in Health, which provides health care for people with HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and other conditions in Haiti, as well as more than eight other countries around the world. He's vocally criticized U.S. destabilization efforts in Haiti, as well as major U.S. corporations that have pursued profit at the expense of global health. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. President Obama has nominated Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, putting her in line to become the country's first Hispanic justice. The 54-year-old Sotomayor is the daughter of Puerto Rican parents who was raised in a public housing project in the Bronx. A graduate of Princeton and Yale, she served as a prosecutor, corporate litigator, and federal district judge before joining the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York in 1998. If confirmed to the Supreme Court, she would become the nation's 111th justice and the third woman to hold a seat on the court. President Obama introduced her in the East Room of the White House yesterday morning and hailed her compelling life story and her experience on the bench.
Over a distinguished career that spans three decades, Judge Sotomayor has worked at almost every level of our judicial system, providing her with a depth of experience and a breadth of perspective that will be invaluable as a Supreme Court justice. It's a measure of her qualities and her qualifications that Judge Sotomayor was nominated to the U.S. District Court by a Republican president, George H.W. Bush, and promoted to the Federal Court of Appeals by a Democrat, Bill Clinton. Walking in the door, she would bring more experience on the bench and more varied experience on the bench than anyone currently serving on the United States Supreme Court had when they were appointed.
Judge Sotomayor thanked the president for what she called the most humbling honor of my life and went on to speak about her background and experience.
Although I grew up in very modest and challenging circumstances, I consider my life to be immeasurably rich. I was raised in a Bronx public housing project, but studied at two of the nation's finest universities. I did work as an assistant district attorney, prosecuting violent crimes that devastate our communities. But then I joined a private law firm and worked with international corporations doing business in the United States. I have had the privilege of serving as a federal district court trial judge and am now serving as a federal appellate circuit court judge. This wealth of experiences, personal and professional, have helped me appreciate the variety of perspectives that present themselves in every case that I hear. It has helped me to understand, respect, and respond to the concerns and arguments of all litigants who appear before me, as well as to the views of my colleagues on the bench. I strive never to forget the real-world consequences of my decisions on individuals, businesses, and government.
If confirmed, Judge Sotomayor would replace Justice David Souter, who was considered a reliable member of the court's liberal wing. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Tuesday the Senate would not be a rubber stamp to confirm Sotomayor and said Republicans would, quote, examine her record to ensure she understands that the role of a jurist in our democracy is to apply the law even-handedly, despite their own feelings or personal or political preferences. President Obama tapped New York Senator Chuck Schumer to lead the confirmation effort. White House officials told the Washington Post they hope to confirm Sotomayor by August 7th.
To discuss Sotomayor's nomination, we're joined by a roundtable panel of guests. Marjorie Cohen is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She joins us from San Diego. On the phone from Washington, D.C., Tom Goldstein, an attorney who founded the popular SCOTUS blog that's devoted to the Supreme Court. Joining us here in our firehouse studio is Cesar Perales, president and general counsel of Latino Justice, formerly known as the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund. Sonia Sotomayor served for many years on the group's board. And on the phone with us from Puerto Rico is Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua, an independent political analyst who publishes a weekly political analysis column for El Vocero. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School, a former professor at Yale University. He knows Judge Sotomayor personally. And according to Juan, who just discovered her Yale Review piece, he is extensively quoted in her piece in the Yale Law Review.
Yes, and welcome to all of you. I'd like to start with Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua. Your reaction to the nomination by President Obama.
My hair stands because I have been, as you know, attentive to the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States for years, 50 years to be exact. And I never expected that the diaspora would produce the first Hispanic Puerto Rican judge in the Supreme Court of the United States. What to me is the crucial element of what we are today celebrating is that for the first time the census issued last summer said that there were more Puerto Ricans in the United States than in Puerto Rico. Now, the diaspora has produced a Supreme Court judge of the United States of America. And now, a bill has been filed in Congress by 90 members of the House of Representatives, finally solving the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States and providing the opportunity of rejecting colonialism in the ballot next year. So, I must confess that it is one of those days in one of those years in which the whole relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States is being transformed before our own eyes.
How did you come to know Judge Sotomayor?
It's fascinating, that story, because we have been friends in the judiciary because, again, I have been part of the political analysis of the relationship, and the judiciary is part of the relationship. And both Judge Sotomayor and Judge Jose Cabranes were the two Puerto Ricans that, since 10 years ago, have been seen as the potential candidates, the potential Puerto Rican candidates to the Supreme Court of the United States. So it was in that sense that that our relationship developed, and it was in that sense that I guess you have discovered I'm being quoted by her in some instances.
I'd also like to bring in Cesar Perales, who also knows Judge Sotomayor personally. And interestingly, Cesar, in the long biography today of Judge Sotomayor that was published by the New York Times, one of the things that they do not mention is that for 11 years, she served on the board of directors of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund from 1980 until 1991, when the first President Bush named her to the federal bench. You were the director at the time. Could you talk about your experiences with her as your boss, in effect, at the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund?
Well, the one thing one immediately learns about Sonia Sotomayor is that she is very smart. She joined the board when she was about, 26, 27 years old. She was the youngest member we had. We brought her on because she was very interested in getting young Latinos to enter the legal profession, and that's one of our mission. Part of our mission. Sonia immediately impressed all of us as certainly held her own against the older members on the board. She's very smart. She's insightful. And to me, who was the guy that had to carry out the wishes of the board, she was very practical in her approach to issues. I can't cite particular anecdotes, which I'm continually asked about, but I can just tell you that my own sense when I was at board meetings was that Sonia was going to be on my side because she'd know that the effects of what her decisions would be, and that she was very careful about that. And I think these are attributes that are going to make a big difference on the Supreme Court. This is a woman that, while we spend a great deal of time talking about her intellect and about her youth and everything she's overcome, but she is very much a practical person. And I think that makes a big difference when you've got the Supreme Court making decisions that affect the lives of everybody in this country.
Your reaction when you heard that President Obama had nominated her to the Supreme Court?
I was ecstatic. And I can tell you, hearing and watching the ceremony, tears welled up in my eyes. As a macho Latino, I shouldn't admit this, but there were many of us standing around this television set in our little kitchen in our office, and there were people bawling. I mean, people who knew her. She's just a regular person, and to see her there, and to see her mother, see the reaction of everybody in that room, I said to myself, Barack Obama likes to make history. He's doing it again today. This is the most important appointment ever made to a Hispanic in this country. And we are very, very pleased. And I think it's going to, you will see that during the confirmation process, because I think if she gets a particularly hard time, people are going, in our community, are going to react very negatively.
We're going to go to break, then we're going to come back to this discussion about the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. We'll also talk about the confirmation hearing, what is expected. But we also want to look at her record. What has been her record, the cases that she has presided over? This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grade. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God.
Billie Holiday, God Bless the Child. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking about the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. Confirmation hearings to follow. If confirmed, she will be the first Latina justice, the third woman on the Supreme Court. Our guests are Cesar Perales, President and General Counsel of Latino Justice, formerly known as the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund. Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua joins us from Puerto Rico, independent political analyst, knows Sonia Sotomayor well. In a moment, we're going to be going to Marjorie Cohen, President of National Lawyers Guild, Professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. But we want to look right now at Judge Sotomayor's record. Tom Goldstein, you founded the SCOTUS blog, Supreme Court of the United States, devoted to the Supreme Court, and you've summarized her cases. Can you go through what you feel are the most important ones and how she's ruled?
Well, the thing about a judge like Sonia Sotomayor, who's been on the Court of Appeals for more than a decade and then was a trial judge for a long time, is that she has an unbelievable body of work. There are literally hundreds of opinions, and we could talk about particular ones, but I think the sort of the overarching point for your listeners is that she is on the left, but far from the radical left. You'll hear a lot of complaints about conservatives that she's an ideologue and a judicial activist. And I think there's really no evidence at all that that's correct. She seems to take each case as it comes to her, and she sometimes rules for plaintiffs, sometimes for defendants, sometimes for the government, sometimes for companies. And you get a sense that she's just very thorough and very balanced, and has been said, and is obvious from how well she did academically, she's very smart.
And go through what you think are some of the principal cases.
Well, I think that one case that maybe we could talk about cases that will receive a lot of attention so that your listeners, as they hear more about Judge Sotomayor, will know what it is that a little bit more about what people are talking about. There is the case that's talked about the most is the so-called New Haven firefighters case. This is a case out of New Haven, Connecticut, where the city had a promotional exam for firefighters. And after the exam was administered, it turned out that white firefighters did much better than black and Hispanic firefighters, particularly black firefighters, and that promotions in the city as a consequence would be skewed. And the city decided not to use the results of that test, but to find another promotional exam. And Judge Sotomayor was part of a three-judge panel that said that the white firefighters didn't have a legal claim against New Haven. So this is a very difficult case about the balance between trying to have diversity in the workforce versus not discriminating against the white firefighters. And that case is now in front of the Supreme Court right now. Another case that tells you a little bit about where Judge Sotomayor stands versus the rest of the Supreme Court that is an issue in front of the justices right now. The justices have a case involving a strip search of a young girl at school because the school had some concern that maybe she had aspirin or some other drugs on her body. And it looks like the Supreme Court is going to rule for the school that that kind of search is okay. Judge Sotomayor had a case in the Second Circuit where she said, no, that's far too intrusive for this poor little girl. And both Judge Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg in the Supreme Court seem much more attentive from their own personal experiences to what that kind of search would be like for a young child, for a young girl. On the other hand, people shouldn't get the impression that she's, you know, always on the left or radical, as I say. She had a case involving accidental mistakes by the police where she said that those don't justify suppressing the results of a search by the police. And the Supreme Court came out the same way this year in a case called Herring. So she's dealt with a huge number of issues, seems to be quite balanced in them, and her decisions are very thorough.
Tom Golston, didn't she also have a key case on environmental issues on how the EPA could use cost-benefit analysis in determining limits on pollution?
Yes, this is the Riverkeepers case. She said that when the EPA was making determinations about what kind of equipment should be used in plants, it shouldn't be evaluating sort of whether this way of protecting the environment was too expensive, that Congress hadn't told the EPA to do that. And so her decision was more pro-environmental. The Supreme Court reversed that decision. So she has been in front of the Supreme Court in opinions that she has written 5 times. That's not that many over a very long career. You're talking about somebody who's been in the Court of Appeals for 11 years, and that's a decision that was reviewed that was reversed.
And you also write, Tom, about the cottage industry that has developed around Supreme Court nominations and how side from both the left and the right gear up for these nominations. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. As with Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, who are really smart people, they are more conservative than me, to be sure, but they have a lot of integrity. They are, you know, good judges. And when they were nominated by President Bush, they were attacked mercilessly by the, you know, folks on the left. And same with Judge Sotomayor, a person of incredible integrity, great intelligence, and now attacked from the far right. And the cottage industry point is that these groups gear up now, and this is their principal fundraising mechanism, to say the president now is trying to either destroy the Supreme Court or save the Supreme Court. You need to support us. And that's not to say that those groups don't have really good faith disagreements about the law. There are incredibly important debates, but what happens, unfortunately, is that we lose sight of the debate, and these individuals who are public servants, Sonia Sotomayor started as a prosecutor, she has been a trial judge and then a court of appeals judge for decades now. She doesn't have 2 dimes to her name. She could have made so much money. And they get attacked mercilessly and personally rather than having the big debates over how the Constitution should be interpreted. So even though it's certain that Judge Sotomayor is going to be confirmed, absolutely certain, absent some totally unexpected ethical transgression, she is going to go through the ringer now so that these groups are able to fundraise.
Marjorie Cohen, you're president of the National Lawyers Guild. Your response to the nomination of the first Latina justice of Judge Sotomayor to the Supreme Court.
Well, Amy, I think it's very significant that she would be the first Latino on the Supreme Court, and she certainly would bring the number of women on the Supreme Court to 2, and that's also very significant. She will not appreciably change the political balance on the court. She will probably be a reliable liberal, very much in the vein of David Souter. Cases about executive privilege will invariably come before her, such as interrogation policies, preventive detention, state secrets, and her views are largely unknown on issues of executive privilege. She is a mixed bag. I would not call her a left liberal. She will not be a William Brennan or a Thurgood Marshall or an Earl Warren. Yes, she has ruled in the ways that Tom said on the firefighters case, on the environmental case, but she is a career prosecutor. She was a career prosecutor, and I'm hoping that she has empathy for criminal defendants and their constitutional rights. She ruled in two significant cases to uphold searches where the search warrants were unlawful. She upheld the Bush global gag rule that made it harder for women to get abortions. She ruled against plaintiff correctional officers who were retaliated against for making complaints. And she also has a significant background as a corporate lawyer. She dissented in a 2-1 decision ruling against the families of victims of the TWA plane crash in New York. So I think she will be a mixed bag. She will probably be more on the liberal side, but I would not call her an unabashed liberal. Now, I think that it's important for us to respond to this whole issue of activist judges and judicial activism, because this is what the right wing is bringing up all over the media waves and throwing at her, that she'll be a judicial activist. All judges are judicial activists. I mean, the quintessential judicial activism was Bush v. Gore, where a conservative majority of the Supreme Court handed the election to George W. Bush. That was judicial activism. On the other hand, if it weren't for judicial activism, the civil rights movement would not have achieved the gains that it achieves, that it achieved. So judicial activism is a red herring. Certainly when Justice Scalia interprets the Second Amendment or Justice Roberts rules in an abortion case, they are being judicial activists. And although nominated justices come before the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate and swear that their views on abortion and the death penalty and gun rights will not affect how they rule, they don't rule in an ivory tower. And judges do make policy. And yes, they interpret the law, but they interpret it through their own political lenses. So I think that's important.
Let's go to that clip that is being played everywhere of Judge Sotomayor speaking at a conference in 2005. It's available on YouTube. It's been played repeatedly on the networks in the last day. In it, Judge Sotomayor says, quote, "A court of appeals is where policy is made." Well, she's now coming under criticism from some Republican lawmakers for the comment. Well, I want to play a slightly longer version of what she had to say. She was at Duke University, where she goes on to clarify this statement.
All of the legal defense funds out there, they're looking for people with court of appeals experience, because it is, court of appeals is where policy is made. And I know this is on tape, and I should never say that, because we don't make law, I know. I know. I'm not promoting it, and I'm not advocating it, Having said that, the Court of Appeals is where, before the Supreme Court makes the final decision, the law is percolating, its interpretation, its application. And Judge Lucero is right. I often explain to people, when you're on the district court, you're looking to do justice in the individual case. So you are looking much more to the facts of the case than you are to the application of the law, because the application of the law is non-precedential. So the facts control. On the Court of Appeals, you are looking to how the law is developing so that it will then be applied to a broad class of cases. And so you're always thinking about the ramifications of this ruling on the next step in the development of the law. You can make a choice and say, I don't care about the next step, and sometimes we do. Or sometimes we say, we'll worry about that when we get to it. Look at what the Supreme Court just did. But the point is that that's the differences.
Judge Sotomayor, Tom Goldstein, your reaction.
I do think that this quote, this one sentence, has been really played far too much out of context. I'm glad you've given the broader context. It's an indication that those who are attacking her have not much to work with, that they focus on this one sentence in a panel where she's kind of making a light joke about, you know, something that's absolutely realistic, as your other guest said, that on some level there are so many holes in the law and ambiguities in the law that you can't ignore the fact that there's some policymaking made at the Court of Appeals level. And then there's this one sentence from a law review article that's taken from a speech she did out at Berkeley. And, you know, when you have somebody who has a career of 11 years, I don't think the public's going to think much of, you know, what she said in these one individual sentences.
I'd like to bring back Juan Manuel Garcia Paz Alacua on both this issue of judicial activism in the federal courts, as well as, again, going back to Judge Sotomayor's own history. I mentioned in my column in the Daily News today the particular irony of Judge Sotomayor being named to the Supreme Court, because it was the Supreme Court that, in effect, legalized the holding of colonies by the United States government back in the early 20th century in what's been known as the insular cases most Americans are not aware of. But now you have the daughter of colonial subjects, in effect, her parents, now being named to that very court. Could you go over some of what those insular cases represented in terms of judicial activism by the Supreme Court itself?
Juan, this is a crucial issue that I think the United States should address through your program from today on. Judge Sotomayor is not a daughter of the American Revolution, okay? Judge Sotomayor was a member of the board of directors of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund, which meant three things. Number one, that she was an ethnic national, a Puerto Rican. Number two, that she felt that ethnic Puerto Ricans deserved and needed a defense. And third, that she dedicated 12 years of her life to that defense, the defense of the Puerto Rican ethnicity within the United States of America. So in that sense, you're absolutely correct in your column today. This is a child of colonialism. This is a woman that is a member of the Supreme Court of the United States because the United States invaded her country, and as a matter of fact, took her parent to war, but that's another issue. The issue is, as you pose it, the issue is the irony of it all that deserves to be discussed is how the daughter of the Bronx gets to be a Supreme Court justice in a colonial relationship between her country and the United States of America. It's going to be a long dialogue, let me tell you. I think we're going to be talking about this for years.
But those Supreme Court insular cases, could you summarize for our listeners and viewers what they involved?
Okay, I'm sorry. The insular cases decided in 1917, the United States Congress granted American citizenship to all those persons born in Puerto Rico. And the Supreme Court in 1922 decided that granting American citizenship to Puerto Ricans did not incorporate Puerto Rico into the American Union on the way to statehood, and created something called the unincorporated territory, which is what Puerto Rico is now, according to the insular cases, precisely Balzac versus Puerto Rico, that was decided in 1922. The fascinating thing is that, again, an entity, an island, 8 million people, 4 million in Puerto Rico, 4 million in the United States. Let's call it a people. 8 million people are part of an unincorporated relationship to the United States, at a moment in which the President of the United States appoints Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, one of those people, one of those people of the unincorporated territory has been appointed Supreme Court Justice. Fascinating. I assure you, Juan, that your book about the consequences of imperialism will have to be reissued after the discussions around the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor go around the block, as they are going to go around the block for months.
I'd also like to ask Cesar Perales, one of the early cases that the that Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund took up when Sotomayor was on your board was the famous Helena Valentin versus Koch case. I think it was 1981, when a series of lawsuits over the elections, local elections in New York City, led to a federal court decision to cancel the New York City elections, or postpone the New York City elections. Could you talk about that?
It's fascinating what happened at that time. It was the post-1980 census period in which the districts were being reapportioned in New York City and elsewhere in the country based on that census. And there'd been a dramatic growth in the Latino community in New York. But the members of the city council drew lines that made it impossible for any new members to be elected. In other words, it was a protection of incumbency, but with clear racial impact. And the board wholeheartedly supported my efforts to challenge those lines. And we devoted a great deal of time to it. We won a decision at the district court level, went to the Court of Appeals, and finally the city tried to get us to the Supreme Court. That and the Supreme Court ultimately, the day before the New York City elections in 1981, which included a mayoral election, issued an order and said they would not intervene. And that, in essence, stopped the election that year. That was a shot heard around the world in terms of voting rights. And I think it speaks to her own commitment to, she supported that action. She obviously is against racial gerrymandering. Now, who isn't? But she very clearly was in a situation in which she encouraged the program on which she served as a board of directors to challenge the government to ensure that the voting rights of Puerto Ricans were maintained. And it was not just Puerto Ricans. I guess there were a number of other minorities involved in the race, including African-Americans.
Judge Sotomayor's view on statehood or independence or commonwealth for Puerto Rico, do you know it?
I don't know it. It's something that we avoided discussing on our board because there are so many facets and it's so volatile that we've tried to stay away from that. And I have absolutely no idea what Judge Sotomayor's position is on the status of Puerto Rico.
Manuel, do you know?
About it either, but I have an indicia that I think the people of Puerto Rico should recognize at this point. In other words, her career, her whole judicial career and legal career has been in defense of the rights of Puerto Ricans, of the 8 million, the 4 million there and the 4 million here. So there is no doubt whatsoever that on what we call the status issue, we don't know what her position is. But when we know about the rights of Puerto Ricans, of all Puerto Ricans, those living here and those living there, she is adamantly, as the name of the organization itself defines, the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund. So her effort is to defend the rights of Puerto Ricans, whatever the status of Puerto Rico may be, a republic, a monarchy, a statehood, whatever the right, the status of Puerto Rico, she's going to be on the right side of the rights as defined by the Constitution of the United States.
I'd like to ask Tom Goldstein, on the issue of the most famous case that's often cited, President Obama cited it as well, the baseball case. What exactly did Judge Sotomayor do there?
Judge Sotomayor called a halt to the strike that threatened to disrupt or seriously wound baseball. This is when she was a trial judge, before she was a court of appeals judge, and she forced baseball to begin its operations again rather than keeping the players off the field. And so it's really regarded as a crucial bit of baseball history because the game was in jeopardy.
But when you say the strike, as a former labor activist, it was actually an owner's lockout,
right,
wasn't
exactly,
it, of the ball players.
Right.
So she was actually stopping the owners from locking out the ball players.
Exactly.
And also significant that she grew up right in the shadow of Yankee Stadium. She grew up in the public housing project. Just want to also mention her parents came from Puerto Rico to New York, but her father died at the age of 9. So she was raised by her mother, something that she brought up yesterday, honoring her mother in the White House when she was nominated. Marjorie Cohen, the New York Times quotes a lecture she gave in 2001 called A Latina Judge's Voice, where she said, "My hope is I will take the good from my experiences and extrapolate them further into areas with which I am unfamiliar. I simply do not know exactly what the difference will be in my judging, but I accept there will be some based on my gender and my Latina heritage." Can you wrap up for us?
Yes. Judges certainly make decisions through the lens of their experience and of their background. And the fact that she is a woman, the fact that she is a Latina, is going to invariably figure into her decision-making and make her, I think, perhaps more sensitive than she might have been otherwise.
And in terms of the composition of the court, you sound somewhat disappointed.
I'm thrilled that there will be the first Latina on the Supreme Court and that there will be another woman. But I really would have liked to have seen a real progressive counterweight to radical rightists on the court, such as Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, Alito, and Roberts. Four of them, yes. I would have liked to have seen an Erwin Chemerinsky, for example, or a Harold Coe, even though they're not women. Erwin Chemerinsky is a white male. But real giants in the area of constitutional rights, civil rights, human rights. I'm very supportive of her nomination, and she should be defended and she should be confirmed. But she is not going to be another Thurgood Marshall. She will not leave an indelible mark on the court, ultimately, the way Earl Warren did or Oliver Wendell Holmes. I could be wrong about that. I think that perhaps Obama missed an opportunity here, aside from all of the incredible qualities that she brings with her. But hopefully, one would say he will have more opportunities to appoint justices.
Well, we want to thank you all for being with us. Marjorie Cohen, president of National Lawyers Guild, professor at Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego. I want to thank Juan Manuel Garcia Basalacqua, independent political analyst in Puerto Rico, knows Judge Sotomayor well, publishes a weekly column, is on radio as well. Tom Goldstein, attorney, founded the SCOTUS blog devoted to the Supreme Court. And thanks so much, Cesar Perales, president and general counsel of Latino Justice, formerly known as the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'd like to know your views as well. You can email us. Just go to our website. Also there, you can follow us on Twitter, and you can make suggestions for stories at stories@democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is it all that Peter is going? Story had never been told.
get up, stand up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, thousands have taken to the streets in California and states across the country after Tuesday's decision by the California Supreme Court upholding Proposition 8, a ballot measure that bans gay marriage. The measure, which defines marriage as solely between a man and a woman, was approved by 52% of California voters in November as an amendment to the state constitution. On Tuesday, the court voted 6-1 to uphold the measure and rejected lawsuits that argued Proposition 8 was not simply a constitutional amendment, but a constitutional revision, which requires the legislature's approval. Chief Justice Ronald George noted in his majority opinion that Proposition 8 still guarantees same-sex couples the right to civil unions and, quote, carves out a narrow and limited exception by reserving the official designation of the term marriage for the union of opposite-sex couples. But Justice Carlos Moreno's sole dissenting opinion reads, quote, even a narrow and limited exception to the promise of full equality strikes at the core of and thus fundamentally alters the guarantee of equal treatment that has pervaded the California Constitution since 1849. Promising equal treatment to some is fundamentally different from promising equal treatment to all. Reaction to the decision has been swift. Hundreds of protesters tried to block traffic near City Hall in San Francisco after the ruling, and over 150 were arrested. In Los Angeles, Jenny Pizer, the marriage project director of gay rights organization Lambda Legal, said the fight was not over and hinted at efforts to push for a ballot measure to repeal Proposition 8.
Proposition 8 stole our right to marry, and it advanced a pernicious idea of equality that puts every California minority at risk. In our view, it was a sad, knee-jerk reaction to people seeing couples celebrating love and happiness with their families. Prop 8 tore our Constitution. Today's deeply disappointing decision puts it to us as a people to repair that damage at the ballot box.
The court's decision does preserve the 18,000 same-sex marriages that took place last year during the few months that gay marriage was legal in California. Gay marriage was permitted by a 4-3 decision from the California Supreme Court last May and then barred after the passage of Prop 8 in November. This is an unidentified gay man protesting Tuesday's decision in front of the San Francisco courthouse. Last year, he married his partner of 22 years.
Well, right now what we have is a kind of a crazy situation. It's like there was a special on marriage last year for 3.5 months, and that special is over. That cannot stand. We can't have 18,000 happy couples happily married, but yet if another couple wanted to get married today, they can't.
Well, I'm joined right now in San Diego by Brian Wildenthal. He's the first openly gay law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Last July, he got married to his partner. Welcome to Democracy Now! You'll be able to remain married, Brian.
Yes, it is a bizarre situation. Like the gentleman said, some of us are essentially grandfathered in for the time being, and we take no joy in that because we see our friends and family members who weren't ready last year and who may be ready this year, but they still have to fight for it.
Talk about the decision.
It's a strange decision. It's the latest episode in a long-running dispute here in California. It started when San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom threw open City Hall and authorized same-sex marriages. California Supreme Court said that was jumping the gun, couldn't do that. Then the California Supreme Court heard a challenge through the regular court process to the laws which prohibited marriage between gay couples. And in a historic decision, a courageous decision last year, the California Supreme Court said that the statutory laws in California violated the California state constitution by not granting equal marriage rights to gay couples. They struck down those laws under the California constitution as it then stood. Then Proposition 8 got put on the ballot, approved by a narrow majority, a simple majority, just 52% of the voters. And so then the California Supreme Court got the case back before them for another round, and that's what they just decided yesterday. And the California Supreme Court decided that that was a valid amendment to the California Constitution. Now, under our California Constitution, you have two different things. You have revisions and amendments. And it has always been thought that only through a revision of the Constitution could a really fundamental, far-reaching change be made. So the issue was, Is that a fundamental, far-reaching change to our Constitution to strip away a fundamental right from a single group of citizens? And in a what can only be described as a disappointing failure of nerve, the California Supreme Court ruled 6-1 that, yes, by a simple majority vote through the amendment process, you could strip away those rights. It did not require a revision. They could have thrown it out by saying that you have to do a revision. A revision requires a 2/3 vote of the state legislature, and only then would it go to the voters. By saying they can do it through an amendment, they're saying that a proposition based on petitions signed by a mere 8% of the voters and then a mere 50% plus one approval can strip away a fundamental state constitutional right. So it's a mixed bag with the California Supreme Court. Justice Carlos Moreno, the sole dissenter from this decision, says this decision doesn't just affect gay couples. It threatens equal protection and equal rights for any minority group, which in California, under our law, they're now at risk. Any minority group, Mormons, Latinos, African Americans, anyone whom the majority might disagree with, can now have their rights stripped away. And that's valid simply as an amendment.
Well, Brian Wilkenthal, where does the gay rights movement go now and the movement for marriage, given especially the fact that in other parts of the country, more and more states are moving to legalize gay marriage?
Yeah, I think we have to go back to the voters, go back to the political process. The court, as I said, it's a mixed bag. I think we've exhausted what can be achieved in the California courts. Very few people, and as a legal expert, as a constitutional law professor who studies the U.S. Supreme Court, that's not going to be an avenue that's going to work under current membership of the court and under current doctrine. So I think we in the gay community and with our friends and supporters throughout this society have to go back to the voters and have a conversation and say, is it right? Should someone be denied a civil legal right simply because some people may disagree with it or disapprove of it? That's not right. You know, we all, as a civilized society to live together, we have to respect the rights of our fellow citizens to have basic rights, regardless of whether we might agree with or disapprove of their marriages or their families.
There's an interesting piece in the LA Times that says two prominent attorneys who argued on opposite sides of Bush v. Gore, the legal battle over the 2000 presidential election, have announced they'll challenge Prop 8 in federal court and seek to restore gay marriage until the case is closed. Former U.S. Solicitor General Theodore Olson and David Boies, who represented then-Vice President Al Gore in the contested election, have joined forces to tackle the same-sex marriage issue. In a project of the American Foundation for Equal Rights, Olson and Boies have united to represent two same-sex couples filing suit after being denied marriage licenses because of Prop 8.
It's a bizarre, it's unfortunate, I think. No one among the responsible gay rights organizations, I think, is supporting that lawsuit. Ted Olson is a right-wing activist. Neither of those gentlemen, whatever they have done, neither of them are well known or have worked with people in the gay and lesbian community. And as a legal expert, it's a non-starter. A lawsuit in federal court is simply going to produce a bad precedent. So I'm puzzled by that. I heard about that, and it's pretty bizarre, I think. Most people in California in the gay community are now focused on going back to the voters, and it's unfortunate that we have to persuade now a majority of our fellow citizens to simply respect our basic rights, but we're confident we can do that. There's overwhelming support among so many groups in California for equal rights. We didn't quite make it with Prop 8. We fell short there, but I think people have woken up now, and the tides are shifting.
Brian Wilkenthal, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us. First openly gay law professor, Thomas Jefferson Law School of Law in San Diego. That does it for the show. Very happy birthday to Flip, to Mike DeFilippo, to Mark Chanel, produced by Mike Berkshire, for Doug Caduce, Aaron Mata, Angela Comet. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.